The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're talking about the fascinating eat-or-be-eaten world of predators and prey. We're joined by freelance science writer Matt Sonyak, who writes about all sorts of interesting predators on his blog at mattsonyak.com. But before we get to that, let's look at the role that hunting has played in human culture. I'm here with show favorite Greg Layton for another edition of Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong. Greg's a biological anthropologist and prolific science blogger at Freethought Blogs and the aptly titled Greg Layton's blog. So today we're going to talk about human beings as predators and specifically about the role of hunting in human culture and evolution. So let's start with the phrase, man the hunter. Now that actually comes from a book, doesn't it?
It does. And actually the phrase man the hunter, the book title and the contents of the book itself is in a way a sort of a falsehood. What happened was, back in the early 60s, a research team from the University of Toronto and Harvard University went out to the Kalahari Desert to embark in the first fully multidisciplinary systematic study of human hunter-gatherers, the Bushmen of the Kalahari. Richard Lee was at Toronto and Irv DeVore at Harvard. John Yellen, who became the head of anthropology at NSF, a bunch of other notables. And this is where the idea that a woman could remain infertile, uses birth control, the idea of, you know, lactating, if you nurse your baby continuously for several months, you won't become pregnant.
Right.
In fact, Marjorie Shostak, who originally discovered this among the Bushmen, that this is what worked for them, was shocked to find about a year later or so when she first came back from the Kalahari that lots of women had gotten pregnant, having heard, you know, she's had sent a letter to someone and it got on the radio, and somehow was the rumor was spread around that this would work as birth control. And there was a little baby boom that happened there among people who wanted to live, go back to nature and live like the Bushmen
did. Of course.
Anyway, that research project was, and some other research done in Africa around the same time, was this, the feature of a Werner Gren conference. A Werner Gren conference is a, the Werner Gren Society had a castle in Austria. And they would invite anthropologists to this castle and they would spend the week and they would have a little conference and then they would publish a book based upon the conference. They still do this, but they named the conference Man the Hunter because at the time it was felt that hunting was the driving force in human evolution. If you ask people today, a lot of people still think it is, but at that time they thought it without any evidence to support the idea. The Man the Hunter conference involved a lot of people talking about how it turns out that hunting probably isn't the driving force of human evolution. It turns out, for example, that what women do rather than what men do is very important. And most of the food in a hunter-gatherer society seems to come from the efforts of women. If you remove the female contribution to diet from a hunter-gatherer group, everyone would starve in a few days. If you remove the male contribution, it would be inconvenient for several days. The point is that within the conference and within the volume that was published, there wasn't a strong man-the-hunter orientation, but Werner Gren stuck with that name. And when they published the volume, to the objection of the editors, Richard Lee and Irv DeVore, at least that's what they tell me these days, over their objection, the term man-the-hunter was used to title the volume. So you can find people's writing in anthropology from the mid-60s and through the 70s complaining about the man-the-hunter volume and how it put forward this male supremacy in prehistory. But only the title does that. In the very introduction, Richard Lee says, well, the one thing we've found from our research is that it's the contribution to women that is much more important and probably more relevant in evolution than the contribution of men. And this will be, and the role of plants and of women in evolution will be seen as important over the next decade. So there's a fallacy there because Man the Hunter is the name of the volume and it really shouldn't have been ever called that.
So do we have a good idea if modern hunter-gatherers are really analogous to our common ancestors then?
Modern hunter-gatherers are probably very analogous to humans for a very long period of our history. Not necessarily our common ancestors with chimps and humans. In fact, we think that the split between chimps and humans, this is an idea that both Richard Wrangham and I had independently several years ago, and we wrote it as a paper that has been fairly widely well-received, that it was actually the shift from eating leaves as your main fallback food, which is what chimps do, to eating roots as your main fallback food, was the thing that split one group of forest apes from another, and the group that switched to eating roots includes the human ancestor. There were probably many species that arose from that, but among those is the human ancestor. So it was actually root eating that splits our common ancestor into a chimpanzee lineage and a human lineage.
There does seem to be some evidence, though, that eating meat played a role in the evolution of modern humans.
Well, later on, what you had is an increase in body size, an increase in brain size with Homo erectus. And for a long time, it was thought that hunting and eating meat would have been the driving force for a number of reasons, including that hunting is hard, you have to be smart, you have to be big, you know, and those things might matter. But again, the same research team, Wrangham, along with Jamie Jones, who's out in California, and Nancy Lou Kunkelin Britton, a diet expert, and David Pilbin and I published a paper that suggested that it was actually cooking that made the difference, and cooking plants mainly. Wrangham wrote a whole book on this. The idea here is that by cooking food, you convert a lot of things that are in your environment that you can't eat now into edible food. Look at almost any cuisine among any traditional group in the world, and the majority of calories that are not meat are cooked. And if you don't cook those things, they're not edible. Okay, so we think the origins of fire, the origin of large body size and larger brains all happens at once. And it's not really hunting there either.
Did humans perhaps scavenge before they started hunting?
Well, that's one idea that people have suggested. And the idea behind that is that scavenging is somehow probably easier than hunting. Well, a number of us have done experiments like this in the field where we've actually gone and tried to scavenge versus hunt in the savannah with the lions and the hyenas. And it turns out that not only does scavenging get you very little, but if there's enough meat on a carcass to make it worth scavenging, there is a pride of lions or a pack of hyenas hanging around that carcass. Much easier to go and find Bambi and kill Bambi somehow than to drive the lions and hyenas off the half-eaten carcass. The scavenging has probably always been something that humans have done since they've been hunting. Scavenging comes along with hunting, but animals that only scavenge, like vertebrates, larger animals that only scavenge, are highly adapted for just that purpose, and there's hardly anything that only scavenges. So scavenging is probably something that humans did, but it wasn't an intermediate stage.
Well, how important would protein be at that point then?
You know, humans are unusual in that we had this long period of development we call childhood, and we have this large brain that is growing and developing during that time period. And it's probably true that a natural diet without meat, meaning wild plants and animals where the plants are cooked but they're not from the grocery store, would, for most groups of people in most places in the world, not be sufficient for supporting the growth of that large brain in infants and children. So personally, I think meat, and a lot of people agree with this, meat is an important food for developing the brain in young children. So now we bring men back into the picture again. They're not completely useless. They do have something to do with raising these large brain children, because in all societies, all cultures where hunting is practiced, most of the hunting is done by men. Women, you don't do much of it. There's all kinds of reasons why we think that women are mostly gathering and men are mostly hunting, and that hunting would be important. And also, it doesn't have to be a daily intake. So if the men don't get meat every day, that's okay, as long as they get enough now and then, that the children get some and the women who are nursing get some. So it's probably important in that way.
Well, then I guess the question occurs to me, and I'm going to get angry letters from vegetarians, but so is a certain amount of meat still necessary in our diet?
Absolutely not. The vegetarians don't need to write you angry letters. Ooh. If you go, next time you go shopping and get a lot of food, just think about where each item originally existed before it was domesticated. Where was that plant originally grown? And, you know, wheat is from West Asia. Corn is from Central America and other parts of the New World. Tomatoes are New World. Think about what a pizza involves, with peppers, anchovies, garlic, tomato, and made of wheat and cheese. You know, what parts of the world are involved ultimately historically in making that thing? You can produce a diet that has all the right proteins and enzymes and everything else from the grocery store that is meat-free and healthy. However, you have to know what you're doing. And knowing what you're doing means basically science-based vegetarianism. You have to actually learn a little bit about it, and it's quite possible, quite easy to do with a mixture of grains and beans and so on. You can get a good diet. It may be a little bit difficult for someone who normally eats meat to make that adjustment, but increasingly people eat meat only a few times a week or a few times a month or even less, and I think it's not hard to do. I think that the easiest diet is one in which you eat meat now and then, and then don't worry about these things too much. But if you don't want to eat meat either for economic reasons, because it's, you know, a bad way of growing food, or because maybe you're tired of pink slime in your hamburger or something like that. There's a lot of good reasons to not eat meat. But if you don't eat meat, especially if you're raising children, you have to be responsible and do it in an effective way.
But under no circumstances are vegetarians short-circuiting evolution.
No, and probably the amount of meat versus that, well, we know that various hunter-gatherer groups. When I say hunter-gatherers are important in understanding our evolutionary past, what I mean is tropical hunter-gatherers mainly, or subtropical, living mainly in Africa. And anybody who's not living there is living in a different environment, and there has to be adjustments made for that. Okay, we know that though for a long time people did live in very cool areas, in subarctic or not quite subarctic, but cold conditions. During the Ice Age, for example, in Europe. And probably the farther you get from the equator, the more meat is in your diet, because the more the plants are inedible and the more the meat is the way to get at your calories. So there are groups of hunter-gatherers who ate probably mostly meat. At the same time, there's probably groups that ate very, very little meat and ate a lot of plants.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with biological anthropologist and blogger Greg Layden, and we're doing another edition of Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong. We're talking about the concept of man the hunter and what it might or might not say about the behavior of modern humans. Now, I've heard that the man the hunter paradigm is used as sort of an explanation for modern behaviors, and especially the things that have a stereotypical gender difference.
Right.
Of course, the big one is the notion that men hunt, women gather, and that's translated into the way men and women shop. Supposedly, men go in looking for something specific, where women tend to browse forever?
I think the most extreme example of that was probably the highly controversial piece written in Nature.
Oh, well, I read that. Yes.
Womanscape. Yeah, I wrote on my blog a response to that, which was, that was a very badly misunderstood piece, because actually it fits very nicely as a form of humor in the context of South African middle class culture, which is where it was written from. But you'd have to be there to understand why it's funny. The thing is, evolutionary psychology, which I am not an evolutionary psychologist, evolutionary psychology tends to try to explain things in those terms, where men hunt, women shop, or men and women shop in different ways or do different things in different ways. Well, consider the following. First of all, men and women are definitely different in one really important way, or a couple of ways. One is that women produce the babies and nurse them. And that is a process that involves all kinds of neurological and hormonal and other physical adjustments. The two sexes are different in these ways. So we would expect those differences to drive primarily any other things that go on. So the reason why in history women gathered and men hunted might be because women were often with a baby, either pregnant or caring for one, and hunting is inconvenient and slightly dangerous for those women. It doesn't mean they couldn't hunt at other times, and it also doesn't mean that gathering is safe. The entire time I lived with FAA pygmies, people were injured hunting and gathering, but there wasn't a sex bias.
Right.
The women were injured by wild animals while gathering more often, in my experience, than men were injured by wild animals while hunting, because you run into things by accident as opposed to you're chasing them and they're trying to get away.
Right.
So gathering is quite dangerous, but there's aspects of hunting that make the baby part hard to do. It's more likely the case that women are gathering for reasons of having a sustainable source of food, meaning a long-term and regular source of food rather than these protein bits, and are sort of in an arrangement with the men where the men are going and getting these proteins. Even when looking at plants, even when gathering plants, where you can tell a difference, women tend to gather the carbohydrate-rich resources and men tend to gather the protein-rich resources, even to the extent that if there's a certain plant that has both, the women will harvest the carbohydrate part and the men will harvest the plant part. Nonetheless, when men are doing this, when men are getting resources that doesn't involve killing an animal, they still call it hunting. Hunting is not going for meat. Hunting is
interesting.
It's a social behavior. It's a way of doing things. It is not the case that modern Canadians or Minnesotans or whatever, that men in those societies act like they do because their ancestors hunted, but rather their ancestors hunt because they are men. And the ancestors of women, as it were, gather because they're women. And the same fundamental things apply universally. We're not looking at an evolutionary leftover when we see differences between men and women. If there's anything about the general difference between men and women, it's just a generalized difference between men and women being manifest in multiple different contexts. And that doesn't have to be built in or genetic or hormonal. It could very well be cultural. It's probably a combination of things.
So then is there any evidence at all that the behaviors that we adopted as a result of learning to hunt are influencing our behavior today?
The evidence is very unclear. It's very weak. The way I like to think, though, is that you know, we've talked a lot about how hunting must be driving human evolution, but it turns out it really isn't. And then, well, maybe it's driving evolution in some other way, but it turns out, well, it really isn't doing that either. Well, maybe there's some other way in which it's doing it. Well, it turns out it's not really doing it. So hunting is trying hard to get into our minds as something that's good. And when you think about it, you look at what archaeologists have done. Archaeologists over the last several decades, or last century, male archaeologists have spent a lot of time communing with male makers of artifacts. The artifacts that male archaeologists tend to be attracted towards, spearheads, weapons, right, pointy things. Okay, these are men communing across the ages with phallic symbols, basically, and interpreting culture and interpreting the present and the past in reference to the same kinds of mystical beliefs and magical beliefs and cultural beliefs that have to do with hunting magic and all kinds of other male symbolic activities like sports and everything else. It isn't that men carry out sports because their ancestors hunted. It's that male ancestors hunted and men today watch sports for probably similar reasons. And those reasons need not be easily described. They need not be overt, symbolic, blatant things. These things are never blatant and overt. They're just weird quirks of psychology that are based on some loose difference in our physiology. And by the way, my lack of belief in the idea that male and females were shaped by evolution to be a certain way, reflected in our modern approaches to shopping and so on, is based partly on the fact that women and men in hunting and gathering societies are not like women and men in Western societies at all. If you look at the differences between men and women in terms of things like assertiveness, social control, attitudes, humor in Western societies and try to apply these to hunting and gathering societies, they don't apply. People are different in different societies, in ways that are bigger than the presumed similarities across humans across evolutionary time.
Greg, as always, wonderful to have you here.
Nice being here. And I also just want to mention that this edition of this particular segment should probably be dedicated to Peter Bergman. Maybe people don't perhaps realize that, but this spot is named after a Firesign Theater album.
And you can find links to Greg Layden's blog on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with science writer Matt Soniak to talk about all sorts of fascinating non-human predators after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Matt Soniak, freelance journalist who writes about science, history, etymology, and Bruce Springsteen. He frequently writes Mental Floss magazine and its website, and his work has appeared in Men's Health, Philadelphia Weekly, Chemical Heritage, The Onion's AV Club, and on scientificamerican.com and cnn.com. His favorite topic, besides Bruce, is animals eating other animals. And so he writes a blog about predators and prey at mattsoniak.com. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
So why a blog about predators and prey exactly?
Well, I sort of fell into science writing more or less accidentally. I tried my hand at a few other beats and wound up in science. It sort of just fit me, I fit it. And when I was looking for a science sort of niche to call my own, something I could really dig into and know inside out and put my mark on, I found that most of the pieces I had the most fun with that I had been writing and most of the sort of studies and research that I was coming across that interested me really all had to do with animals either trying to eat other animals or those animals trying not to get eaten.
How do you decide what predators and prey to write about? Because there are a lot, I realized, after we named this episode.
Everyone has to eat somebody. And if they're not trying to eat somebody, they're trying not to get eaten by somebody else. There's a couple criteria. You know, something has to beat if I'm really going to commit pen to paper to it. I like to write about stuff that, well, I sort of like to force myself to write about stuff that scares me. I'm terrified of spiders, and I'm a little creeped out by bats. I think if you go through my blog, you'll find that I write about those two groups almost more than anything else.
So really, this is like therapy for you?
Yeah, it's... Wow. I guess I'm just a glutton for punishment. And then the other thing I always look for is something sort of unconventional or quirky, whether it's about the animal itself or the research that's being done on it. Mantis shrimp are these sort of cute, cuddly little marine creatures. They're like these bright neon colors, and they're really beautiful, and they seem pretty harmless with these cute little googly eyes. But they have these really nasty claws, like that either come in like a spear variation or a hammer variation. Both of them are really going to ruin your day. I'm working on a piece right now about rogue seals. There's been cases in the U.S. and then Europe and then Canada where these individual problem seals have started attacking and killing members of their own species. And also going after commercially important fish species and sort of getting these conflicts with fishermen. It's not something you expect from seals, almost. Everyone sort of thinks of them as these cute, fluffy lumps that sit on the rocks all day. But they're dangerous, too.
And most species are both predators and prey, of course. You actually wrote a post on that topic, using snakes as your example.
It's probably not outrageous to assume that our ancestors came in contact with snakes more than we do. You know, I live in the middle of Philadelphia. I can't remember the last time I've seen a snake. My girlfriend has lived here all her life. I don't think she has ever seen a snake in person outside of the zoo. And even in that case, she just closes her eyes and rushes through the reptile house. But venomous snakes always attack soft tissue. And constrictors almost always swallow their prey whole and leave the remains elsewhere and go on with their day. So you can't really play CSI with that. You can't go into the fossil record to see what sort of interactions we've had with snakes in the past, whether they've eaten our ancestors or not, whether that's 200 years ago, 2,000, 2 million, what have you. So you sort of have to approach that problem differently. So this anthropologist, Thomas Hedlund, what he does is he takes his new bride and he leaves with her for the Philippines. And they spend the next 24 years living with this indigenous tribe there. They're called the Agta Negritos. Up until then, these guys had been sort of nomadic hunter-gatherers. And they're not a big people either. Adult men are maybe just shy of 5 feet tall. They tip the scales at like 100 pounds at their heaviest. In other words, they're not that dissimilar in size and lifestyle to some of our ancient hominin ancestors. And they live in close proximity to, it would probably be easy prey for, a species of snake called the reticulated python that they share the jungles with. So Hedlund is down there, and he does a sort of formal survey of them about these snakes, and finds that of all the men he's talked to there, about 25% of them have been attacked by a python at one point or another. And then I think one of 62 women had done the same. They apparently played it a little safer, good for them. And all the folks he's talked to, collectively, they can remember that 6 people have also been attacked and then were killed by these snakes, at least a few of them eaten by them. In turn, you know, almost every one of these guys he talks to has at some point killed a python. And while he's down there, one guy even shoots a 22-footer, and then they have a little cookout with it. They butcher it and they eat it right there.
That post specifically sort of had an evolutionary psychology spin.
Yes.
Do tell.
It could. You know, the flip side of the coin is that these guys had also, you know, they had hunted the snakes, the snakes had hunted them, and then when they're not doing one of those two things, they found that they shared a lot of prey. They would cut open some of these snakes and find a lot of the same species that they regularly went after. So they've got these sort of very tight, interwoven histories, and it begs the question, you know, a lot of people are afraid of snakes. And is that sort of a hardwired instinct? Are they sort of like an evolutionarily relevant threat to us? And that's why it's so common. That's a very tricky question to answer.
Well, and that's what I find interesting because, yeah, as you said, you don't really have a science background. So yeah, if you're looking at these sort of recent studies that are coming out and you want to write a blog post about them, how do you figure out what is science?
How does my BS filter work?
Well, regular listeners will understand that I have sort of a love-hate relationship with evolutionary psychology.
Yeah.
So how do you discern what is science, sir?
Well, like I said, I have no science degree. I sort of fell into this by total accident. But I'm fairly well-read. I'm not, you know, I'm a clever guy. I'm scientifically literate. When it comes to hype and maybe some of these overly bold claims, I'm not in the business of breaking science news, you know. There's a pretty long gestation period on some of my posts. So it's stuff like that I can sort of look into the history of an idea and see if it passes muster. And if a conclusion doesn't add up for me, or a method or a data point seems sort of fishy, I am not so vain as to not ask for help. I'm a curious guy, I'm pretty smart, but I'm not an expert, and I've never felt bad about calling up a scientist, introducing myself, and then, you know, asking a lot of really dumb questions sometimes.
Hey, that's the story of my life.
And for something like the snake thing, you know, there's some research that shows that kids pick snakes out of, you know, a scene more quicker than other objects. Maybe because it's hardwired, possibly. And then there's other research that says, well, sure they do that, but you have to note that kids don't necessarily associate fear or any other emotion with these snakes. They have to learn it from adults first.
Right.
Most of the time, you know, you're going to see a snake, and then if you look up at your mother or your father and they see the snake and they look scared, you're going to start to associate fear with snakes. Whereas, you know, if you're like Steve Irwin's kid, that probably won't happen because he's not going to show it on his face.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Matt Soniak, freelance science writer, about his strange fascination with predators and prey. I think what's really interesting about the topic of predators and prey is the variety of methods by which a species becomes prey, because there are a whole lot of ways, creative ways of killing things. Oh, yeah. So maybe let's start out with bats. Because, okay, as you said, you got a thing about the bats, and you have written a bunch of posts on them. So how do bats hunt?
Most people have, you know, at least some idea of what echolocation is. You know, bats send out these sort of supersonic calls and then listen for the echo signature that bounces back at them. That's sort of how they pick out these bugs that are flitting around.
What I'm interested in is they routinely hunt very, very venomous prey. And you wrote a study looking at how bats hunt scorpions.
In the sort of Middle East area, there is a scorpion called the Palestine Yellow Scorpion. Everything you need to know about this guy can be summed up in its nickname, which is the Death Stalker. They're little, but they've got a poison in them that packs a grab bag of neurotoxins. It can paralyze you, basically shut down your heart, your lungs, and your brain in a couple minutes, even if you're a large adult male, human. Certainly, smaller animals like bats are going to have an even tougher time with them. But for some reason, there's this bat called the Hemprix long-eared bat that just doesn't seem to be bothered by it. When they hunt, you know, they shoot out their calls, they listen for the echo. Anything they pick up on, they will sort of immediately attack. Even these things, they don't seem to show a preference for the size of the prey or even inspect to see, you know, go in, take a closer look and see if it's one of these very poisonous scorpions. They just go for it. As soon as they sense it, they attack it. They start biting their heads. And while this is going on, the scorpions don't really just lie down and take it. They fight back. They sting the bats on their head, their face, their chest, their wings, sometimes right in their eyeballs. And the bats just keep going. They eat the whole thing. They eat the stinger. They eat the poison gland. They eat the claws. They don't seem to have a care in the world about this.
Then are they fearless, or do they not care, or are bats really dumb? I think that's what I'm asking.
Is it courage or stupidity? No one is quite sure. There was a study done on these guys in Israel. You know, round after round, they just watch these things, eat them without a care, getting stung and pinched the whole time with no ill effects whatsoever. You know, a couple stings by these, and you and I might drop dead. The bats, nothing happened. Like, didn't slow them down, nothing. So researchers think that they have at least a partial tolerance to the venom. And pretty much it's more or less a cast iron stomach.
But they do choose what to hunt often. They don't just go after the first thing that flies or runs past, correct?
Right. Some of them don't. The conventional wisdom was that bats always hunted like these Hemprix long-eared bats do, based on biased information. Some insects or some prey, whether they're bigger or they just move around more or they have a more rapid wing beat, it's basically going to give the bat biased information. It's going to be overrepresented in the echo signature. And so for a long time, scientists thought that every bat was just going to go after what was obvious, not necessarily what was tastier or what was the preferred prey or what was, you know, not going to try and kill them immediately. Mm. But more recently, they've been looking at guano, which are these big piles of bat dung. And here and there, various researchers have been noticing that in these piles of guano, there's more large insects than should be expected by chance or by, you know, hunting by biased selection. Sometimes the percentage of a certain species of bug will be more well represented in the guano than it should be, given the abundance of that species in that area. So something wasn't quite adding up, and it made people start to think, well, maybe they're actually picking their prey. Maybe they are a little more selective than we thought. So these guys in Germany rig up a bunch of fake insects. They're little remote-controlled propellers, basically little whirligigs. And some of them are smaller and move a little slower. Some of them are bigger, move a little faster. And they collect these bats, and they turn them loose on these little robots. And every time they catch a little propeller, they get a mealworm wing as a prize. And whenever they catch a big one, they get a whole mealworm. And through the experiment, they decide they're going to vary the conditions of the bug market, as it were. They're going to change the frequency of small bugs and big bugs and the amount of time between their appearances. So they're sort of simulating different conditions of bug density and abundance for the, you know, the smaller, less desirable bugs and these bigger bugs that are going to give them a little more caloric bang for the bat's buck. And they found that all the bats adjusted their selection to the different wait times between the appearances of the large bugs. When the big ones weren't that available, they would attack both the big ones and the small ones. And then when the big ones were more available, they almost rejected the small ones outright and just took the big ones because they were more readily available. There were more of them and they came more frequently. So there's at least some species. This was done with a species called the horseshoe bat. They're a little more savvy. They're pretty smart shoppers, and they're choosing their prey based on the echo information they get back and these sort of echo signatures that they associate with these bigger bugs and more energy profitability.
We have some questions coming in. It is a non-bat-related question from Twitter.
Oh, darn.
It's from Michelle.
Lions, tigers, or bears? Discuss.
Oh, my.
Michelle, that's going to be my favorite question, no matter what else comes in. Thank you.
I hope it's not a cop-out if I say none of the above.
Ooh.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm just assuming what this the heart of the question is, but I think pound for pound, killer whales are probably, you know, bigger, scarier, and tougher than any three of those. You know, we all think of Shamu and Free Willy, and they're so cute and innocent, and they play with beach balls and they'll eat fish out of your hand, but they also eat polar bears, and they also eat great white sharks. You know, which people tend to think of as the top predators on both land and sea. And Shamu's going to kill both of them.
I really hope there are no children listening right now, because you've just caused nightmares. Okay,
that is what I do.
Good job, sir. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about spiders, because you mentioned them, and I'm helping with your therapy. That's what I'm telling myself.
I appreciate that, sure. Mm-hmm.
We'll work through it.
Yeah.
So we've talked a lot on this show, actually, about spiders as hunters, but their defense mechanisms aren't discussed as often. Now, you wrote some posts about how they use decoration to avoid predators. So let's talk about the research on the St. Andrew's cross spider.
The St. Andrew's cross spider is what we call an orb-weaving spider. They make those nice concentrically ringed spider webs that we tend to think of as the Platonic ideal, something that, what's the story? Charlotte's web,
right.
Something like her web. And these webs, they need to be inconspicuous enough that a bug will fly into it without noticing it and get caught and become dinner. At the same time, it needs to be conspicuous enough that you or I or a dog or another large animal isn't going to just walk into it and smash it and destroy it. Because then the spider has to take time out of its day to build a new one. And that's time it could spend mating or hunting. And then when it's building the web, it's also exposed to predators. So it really just wants to keep the web as it is. Doesn't want you to mess with it. So what the St. Andrew's cross spider does is it pulls off sort of a contradictory signaling paradox. It constructs these little zigzags of silk across their webs. They decorate it in a way. And while it, you would think it sort of makes it, it makes it more conspicuous to everyone, for some reason the bugs don't seem to notice it, but bigger animals do. These Australian researchers thought that these zigzags had sort of a protective effect. So they called all these spiders, and they divided them into three groups, and they let them build their webs on these plastic frames in their lab. And the first group, once the webs were done, they left them alone. Group two, they did what they called light damage. They, you know, they cut a few threads here and there to simulate the damage that might be caused by, you know, just like little bugs flying into it, maybe a thread or two breaks. Mm-hmm. And nothing big, just regular, you know, web wear and tear, if you will. And then the third group, they caused what they called heavy damage. You know, they cut a quarter of all the threads, and then two of the anchor threads, basically just bringing the thing on the brink of collapse. And so they do this for 14 straight days. Every time the webs get rebuilt, they just take them down again. And they found that in the first two groups, the ones that they didn't touch and the ones where they only caused a little damage, the portion of spiders that built these little decorations went from about 25% to 50% of the group. And in the groups whose webs got really messed up, it went up from 25% to 81%. So they think that is a pretty clear reaction to home wrecking. It's sort of a tactical response.
Did by chance they measure spider nervous breakdowns after those 14 days? Because that seems awful.
Yeah, they sat the little guys down on a couch and they talked to their feelings.
Now, since we're talking about spiders, I'd like to talk about harvestmen.
Which are not spiders.
Right, right. Which I'm here is my disclaimer, because we are discussing spiders, and although harvestmen aren't spiders, they are arachnids and they look like spiders anyway. So please hold off on those angry emails. I do understand. So harvestmen, studies show that they are awesome. Do tell.
They're so cool. The oldest known penis on an animal belongs to a harvestman. They brought the wiener into this world. And you gotta love me if only for that. But yeah, they're very cool. They have these little glands up near their head, and they make all these chemical secretions. They're for communication. They're for defense. They can use them to clean out their wounds. They're like antibacterial communicating chemical weapons. They solve all problems all the time. These guys are jacks of all trades. They also have these very hard exoskeletons that can protect them from, you know, from most injuries from animals of similar size. I'm not going to say it's going to protect them if you squash them, but you never know. Common sense would dictate that relying on this exoskeleton is probably going to be the cheapest and best defense option. If you're using these chemical secretions for all sorts of things, you might not want to waste them to, like, scare away a predator if it's a lot easier to just, you know, take a punishment. A couple whacks, exoskeletons can do the job, you run away. Why use the chemical weapons? This is at least sort of makes sense, but
right.
Harvestmen are sort of a neglected group. They don't get a lot of attention. One third of all known species were described by just one guy. Eccentric fellow, maybe. But a deep appreciation for these things. So no one really knows, you know, what the sort of hierarchy of defense option is when these things get into trouble. So these Brazilian researchers decide that they're going to do my absolute favorite thing in the world and arrange arachnid cage matches.
Science is awesome. Sorry, yeah. Do continue.
So they take these harvestmen and they take some spiders that eat harvestmen and they take some crickets. And they pit the spiders against the crickets and the harvestmen in these different cages. And they throw the spiders in, and almost immediately, every cricket in the tank gets eaten. No survivors. It's a cricket slaughter. All the harvestmen survive, though. Only, like, a few get attacked, and the spiders attack them once and then immediately back off. So, to see if it's actually, you know, if they're using these chemical defenses, they plug up some of the harvestmen's glands with glue, and they leave some of them able to defend themselves chemically. And they throw the spiders in again, and the same thing happens. They attack once or twice, they back off, they leave them alone. No fatalities. So to get to the heart of the matter, then they decide, let's separate the chemicals from the harvestmen. They take the spiders, they feed them a fly, and, you know, as soon as they open their little mouths to take a bite to get this hard-earned reward after fighting, you know, there's an eyedropper in their face spraying these harvestmen chemicals right in their mouths, and it doesn't seem to have any effect. It doesn't bother them at all. So far you've got harvestmen who aren't resisting. They're not biting, they're not fighting, they're not running. And even if they are secreting these chemical defenses, the spiders don't seem to be bothered by them. So what's left but the exoskeleton? So these researchers, they decide they're going to rigor match. And they're just going to let the spiders get up real close and bite the harvestmen as much as they please. So they hold these guys down, you know, they force them to lose. And then they look up at it close to see how the spiders are biting and where they're piercing the body armor. And they realize that they're not really. The teeth just won't go through. So they look at the harvestmen with a scanning electron microscope, a fancy microscope, and it sort of shows that there's really only one part of the harvestmen where there's, you know, a weakness in their armor, the sort of Achilles heel. And basically, their whole outside is hardened except on their back, their bottom, their sides, their legs. And the only little unprotected spot is right by its mouth. And then the articulations in the legs, what, you know, would be our elbows and knees and ankles. And that's sort of where the only spot that the spider can bite them. And then the harvestmen sort of get around that by, you know, they sink their body down and pick their legs up all around them, building a fence of legs. And the soft parts, which are their knees, are sort of held up above them. So you sort of have to attack from the top. And looking at these very close-up, slow-motion videos of the biting that was happening, they realized that, you know, the spiders, either they don't realize it or they're just not lucky enough to get up there. They can barely find a spot to sink their teeth into. So the harvestman is just, he's just a very hard guy.
Butch is the term you're looking
Butch.
For.
Butch. Yeah, yes, that's, thank you. That's the technical term.
Yeah. We have a couple of questions from the audience, and none of them are about spiders at all. Nobody wants to help you with therapy, love.
Okay.
This one is from Kimberly.
Are there any predator-prey relationships that get turned around? I.e. the prey can turn on and kill, possibly eat, the predator a reasonable percentage of the time? I can't think of any, but thought I would ask an expert.
Oh. Well, I'm hardly an expert, but that made me blush. A reasonable amount of time I wouldn't know how to define, but yeah, things often go wrong for a predator during a hunt. If you look at wolves, you know, they're hunting a lot of prey that is much larger than them and happens to have horns or antlers. You know, they go after deer, they go after elk, they go after moose, they go after bison. They'll go after domestic cattle, all of which are very large, very serious creatures, even if they seem sort of docile. And horns and antlers will mess you up. There are a lot of cases where, you know, a pack of wolves will go after something and just like one hit from a moose antler, that's going to break ribs, that's going to damage your internal organs. And there's no first aid within a wolf pack. There's not a whole lot they can do for you after that, after you get gored. So, yeah, wolves often take their lives into their hands when they go out for a meal. And we were talking about snakes before. There have been a couple documented cases where snakes have gone after groups of monkeys. And the monkeys have basically retreated for a bit, regrouped, and then come back and mobbed the snake. Sometimes just sort of beating it with their fists, and in a couple cases even attacking it with sticks, sort of just beating it and then even spearing it.
Well, on that note, you're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Matt Soniak, and we'll be right back to talk more about predators and prey after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, guest host Marie-Claire Shanahan spends the hour with science writer David Dobbs to talk about his book Reef Madness, Charles Darwin, Alexander Agassiz, and the Meaning of Coral. The book recounts the century-long controversy over the origins of coral reefs and its relationship to the history of evolutionary theory. They'll discuss the challenges of writing the stories of science and the importance of sharing them with a wide audience. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and my guest today is Matt Soniak, freelance science journalist, and he writes a blog that focuses on particularly compelling research around predators and prey. So we've talked about bats and spiders and all those things, and apparently lions, tigers, and bears. But rather than talk about all those obvious suspects, I'd like to talk about maybe some species that we don't talk about very often, or at least that I don't get to talk about very often. And you mentioned the mantis shrimp. Talk a little bit more about what that is.
Mantis shrimp, which are neither mantids nor shrimp, but they sort of look like if the two got together and had a baby, which is where the name comes from. Basically come in two varieties. They're these cute little marine creatures, and some of them have spear claws that they jab into prey, and then some of them have what are generally called smasher claws. And these things work sort of like a crossbow does. It's a spring and catch mechanism. They basically ratchet their arm back at what I guess you could call their elbow if you're into comparative anatomy. So they ratchet that back, and then it locks into place. And all this potential energy gets stored up. And then when they're ready to strike, they twitch this certain muscle, and the thing unleashes. And all that energy gets released at once. It moves at about 45 miles an hour when it does, which is the fastest known limb movement in the animal kingdom. And when it hits whatever the mantis shrimp wants to hit, it comes down with 340 pounds of force. So these things are regularly hunting down crabs and snails and just smashing right through their shell. They're cute little guys, but they're a force to be reckoned with.
And it's not just their claws, it's their tails. So talk about right. That study, yeah. Because, wow, sometimes the way that these things are tested, it leaves an impact, one would say.
Oh, huh. Yeah. The flip side of that is, as hard as they can hit, they have a little junk in the trunk that is equally as hard. They don't just smash prey with these things. Or I've heard a couple stories where people had these things in aquariums and they would just smash right through the glass and drain the whole thing, drying out and killing their neighbors in there. But instead of just going after prey, they also use these things on each other when they're fighting over territory. So, 340 pounds of force coming down on each other. Like, how have they not beaten to each other into extinction? And that's because of the armor they have covering their butts, as it were. They only hit each other in a part of the tail called the telson before they they really get into it, they sort of have this ritual where they do a couple test blows onto each other. And the Telson is sort of interesting. And how they found out about it is even better. I should start there, I guess. These researchers, they took some mantis shrimp and they killed them. But before that, they gave them a nice farewell. And they put them in a plastic cup and they fed them some grass shrimp. And they lived out the last of their days in truly high style. And then they went into the freezer and they froze to death. And then got pulled out before they were completely frozen solid. And what the researchers did then was they super glued them to a strip of plexiglass and took some stainless steel balls and dropped them on these corpses from great heights to see how the Telson would react. It's a little morbid, it's a little ridiculous, but...
But it works.
The shrimp gave their lives for a good cause. After they bombarded these bodies with stainless steel balls, they looked at a high-speed video recording of it. And what they were trying to figure out was what's called a coefficient of restitution. This is basically a value that represents an object's elasticity. And they figure that out by looking at the loss of momentum a colliding object, like a stainless steel ball, suffers when it hits the other object that they're looking for at. You'll often find a coefficient of restitution assigned to stuff like body armor or a car bumper or like a football helmet, stuff that's going to take a lot of impact. So they find out that these shrimp Telsons have a coefficient of restitution that's about 0.56. When a major league baseball hits a baseball bat at a pro game, their restitution is about 0.45 or 0.50. So when a stainless steel ball hits a mantis shrimp's Telson, the ball loses about 69% of the energy it had going into it, which is a pretty big loss. It slows down significantly, and the Telson takes a lot of its power away. And this that big of a loss of energy implies that the Telson is acting inelastically. It's not crumpling, it's not giving in and then bouncing back. It's just taking the hit, sort of like a heavy punching bag does.
Well, now wait, I'm curious about something. I want to go back a bit. The idea that when different species are fighting over territory, often there are fights. But how do they manage, especially these guys, how do they manage not to kill each other? Because it almost seems like the goal is not to kill each other, it's just to prove a point. So I want to be guilty of anthropomorphizing a bit, but Okay. Do they know this somehow?
I don't think so. Coming up next is pure speculation on my part. That make sure you remember that. Because, I will anthropomorphize a little. It does seem that if they're hitting each other only on a spot they can take it,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe they're just... They're posturing, it seems, almost, instead of trying to take their opponent out and just be done with him. But then you sort of have to ask yourself, well, is the knowledge that this certain part of the tail can take that much of a hit, is that innate, or is that something they learn?
Right.
And
why do they care, honestly? Yeah. Why do they care?
I'm not going to be so bold as to speculate on that, because I don't think I've heard of social learning in a lot of animals, but certainly never mantis shrimp. I think that might be pushing it just a little bit.
All right, we have a bunch of questions, so let's get to some of them. An email from Daryl.
Is there a defensive strategy that you think is more effective than the rest? Camouflage, spines, tasting really gross? What would you choose if you were trying to keep from being eaten?
Oh, if I could pick one superpower. Well, tasting really gross has something going for it. Unfortunately, you have to... You don't want to be the first one of your species to try that. Like, the guinea pig is always going to get eaten until the predators learn their lesson. That's something you really want to have maybe a couple hundred generations into it. But if if I had to be the first of the humans to have a new adaptation, I guess it would be some sort of chemical defense. Maybe some sort of stinging, stinky chemical that I could just shoot out whenever I wanted. That would be pretty cool.
Like what animal? Compare that to something. A stinging, stinky chemical.
A stinging, stinky chemical. Sort of like mace that I could just shoot from my wrists or something. Well, I guess that's sort of like what the Harvestman does. Or even a skunk, except without the stinging so much, I guess. More just the stink.
And we are almost out of time, so I'm just going to leave you with that. do you have any parting thoughts, perchance, on Predators and Prey that you'd like to leave us with?
I'll say this. I talked about writing about predators because they interest me. And I guess the initial interest I found was that, like, because I'm basically an overgrown, morbid kid, I love blood, I love guts, I love H.P. Lovecraft and George Romero.
Woo.
And what initially sparked my interest in writing about predators and sort of making that my beat is that they're sometimes like real-life monster stories. But on a deeper level, I think what's maintained my intellectual interest beyond, you know, that excitement for gore and that bloodlust, and what a lot of people I don't think realize, is that predation is a very powerful force in the natural world. There was a poet named Robinson Jeffers, and he wrote this line that I really love, and that says, "What but the wolf's tooth whittled so fine the fleet limbs of the antelope?" And if you look at a situation like Yellowstone National Park down here in the States, in the late 20s, the government basically eradicated all the wolves in the park. And without these wolves keeping them in check, the park's elk population blew up. They ran through the place like locusts. And the plants that they normally ate couldn't bear the weight of the population. So you've got whole stands of these important food plants disappearing, and the soil's eroding, and the weeds are cropping up everywhere as replacements. And the animals that depend on these plants and the animals that depend on, you know, scavenging on these wolf kills suddenly are without their buffet. And the whole makeup of the park changed. And then, you know, a couple decades later, they decide, well, maybe, you know, correlation doesn't necessarily mean causation. But let's try bringing the wolves back and see what happens. So they fly these wolves down from, of all places, Alberta.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
And they reintroduce them to the park. And everything rebounds. It went back to the way it once was. And the same sort of thing is played out almost everywhere else large predators get removed from an area, both by taking down some prey and creating this sense of fear in the other animals. Predators are very effective top-down managers. They are major ecological movers and shakers. And I think that's something that they don't get a whole lot of respect for outside of biologists and ecologists, especially when the average person might see them as, you know, these mean animals that eat all the cute, cuddly things. They are just so important to the way the world works, because out there, you know, beyond our little bubbles and our cities, violence is still the prince of this world.
Nicely done, sir. You can check Matt out at mattsoniak.com, and we've also linked to him at skepticallyspeaking.com. And since you're there anyway, might as well click the link to Twitter, to Facebook, to Google+, and to iTunes, where you can download past episodes or subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking. One more thing for those of you in or near Edmonton. Skeptically Speaking is excited to be a guest at the 2nd Annual Logicon, a science-focused fun-for-the-whole-family event. On April 14th and 15th, Logicon returns to the TELUS world of science to once again grab all the scientists and science enthusiasts that they can find, jam them together in one place, and shake it to see what awesome stuff falls out. And of course, we here at Skeptically Speaking think that's a pretty fantastic objective. After the success of the first Logicon in 2011, this year's event has been extended to 2 days, and Reactive, an 18-plus party, has been added to the schedule on Saturday night, which is April 14th. The party will offer science demos and live electronic music by Edmonton's most talented artists, and it kicks off with my live Skype interview with Maggie Kurth-Baker, Boing Boing science editor and author of Before the Lights Go Out, Conquering the Energy Crisis Before It Conquers Us. You can find out more about Reactive and the rest of the Logicon event schedule at the link on our website. See you there.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically, that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.